The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program Olin Steinhauer. He joins us on the telephone in New York State. Hello, Olin.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Olin, I love having you on the program. I can't even remember how many times it's been now, but any excuse I get.
Well, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
In fact, if I really liked a book, I will try to double dip, and this is a classic example. My favorite novel last year was your novel, The Middleman, and since it just came out in paperback, I use this as a pretext to invite you back, and here you are.
Yeah, here I am. So, yeah, thanks.
The Middleman, this is kind of a different book for you. Remind me why I like this book so much. What's it about?
Well, I'm not sure why you liked it, but I can tell you what it's about. I mean, what's different? So what's different about it is all my previous books took place primarily outside of the United States, and their focus was very much international relations and sort of the inside baseball of spying. But after many of these books, I sort of realized, and actually in the meantime, I had moved from Budapest back to the United States. And my wife and I have a daughter who's now, you know, in American schools. And I was becoming sort of drowned by the political realities of America, which I had always been aware of and conscious of and had my opinions on. But I had never really written directly about the American social and political landscape. And I decided it was time to do that. And so as a result, The Middleman focuses pretty much entirely on the sort of the United States landscape. It even traverses the country as it's following a sort of a politically left-wing underground group that is or is not, depending on your perspective, a terrorist group, as an FBI agent is slowly digging deeper. Actually, a couple FBI agents are slowly digging deeper into it to figure out how to stop it before things get really bad.
And one of those agents is Rachel, is it Prue?
Yeah, Rachel Prue, yeah.
Okay.
P-R-O-U-L-X. I had some really boring last name, and then I discovered that. I said, okay, there we go.
All right.
That's a beautiful one.
Tell us about her.
Well, she has, she is someone, I'd wanted to focus on a female central character. I do have them in my books, but they're not as prevalent as I would like. So I really wanted to focus on one. And she's an ambitious FBI agent who once upon a time was interested in joining the United Nations. She was more idealistic. And then as time passed, she ended up falling in with the FBI. And she's ambitious, but she also comes, she's also a woman who has sort of dealt with the difficulties of being a woman, particularly before this point, and then sort of throughout the story you have these moments. And partly it's from an abusive relationship she came out of, which sort of comes to a head later on. And I think her journey, I was really pleased with how her journey turned out. And yeah, it's all very interesting to do it from a female perspective when quite often these sort of action-y books are done from the male perspective.
She is tracking something known as the Massive Brigade. Tell us what that is and how it's being formed. It's almost like an organism. Suddenly it just has all these cells attaching to it.
Yeah. So this is the idea, the movement of it is that it all starts with this sort of social activist named Martin Bishop, And he's sort of the theoretician of the group. He's the one who puts the massive brigade together. And, you know, at first it's sort of like any sort of movement. It builds up through public talks. You know, he does a tour of universities, so supposedly speaking truth to power. And his position is it's not necessarily left or right, but what it is, it comes down to a basic feeling that democracy has failed in America. Mm. Politicians no longer listen to the voters. They do everything to accumulate and maintain power, and that the voting booth itself has failed. And so, in his way of looking at it, the way to deal with this is to instill fear in politicians, actual physical fear. And that's the only way forward. And this is why people are horrified by this group, by the way they speak, because they assume the next thing must be bombs in shopping malls or something like that. And one day, I forget the number because it's been a year, but we'll say many thousand of young followers of the massive brigade disappear all at once. They leave their cell phones behind, climb out their bedroom windows, or just walk out of their houses, throw away their ID, and simply vanish into America. And the whole group moves underground. And as you learn, this is partly a defensive move because they found out that the FBI was going to pen some crimes on them and arrest the leaders. But then it becomes much more complicated than that, as Rachel Prue is trying to find them, trying to track them down, but also trying to find what they're actually doing, which is sort of the mystery that is eventually answered by the end of the book.
Okay. Sounds like your neighbor's doing a little remodeling.
It's a housekeeper. Is it too noisy?
Oh, that explains it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. My guest is Olin Steinauer. The book is The Middleman, and he joins us on the telephone in New York State. Olin, some of our listeners were probably scratching their heads a moment ago saying, well, this doesn't really sound like fiction. Some of this sounds like he's writing about what's really going on today, about the political process and all that. And I should point out that the book starts off right at the beginning of President Trump's term.
Yes, it does. I mean, I had planned this book, and I had various ideas for this of a book like this since the 1990s when I was living in Austin, Texas. And it was sort of my exposure, actually, to, of all things, punk rock music. And there was this band called The Nation of Ulysses. And like a proper punk band, they produced two sort of phenomenal records and then imploded. And their whole sort of shtick was that they were all part of this secret underground revolutionary group. That was the whole their shtick, and it was all very amusing and kind of fun. But I remember thinking at that time, one of these days I'm going to write a book about some underground group in America that's kind of pushing for revolution. And of course, then that idea got sort of buried over the years. And when I started, and this was during the late Obama term. And I started seeing how divisive politics were in America. And I started realizing that I might be able to mesh these two ideas together. And that's how I started working on it. But I have to admit, I wrote an early draft of it before the election. And then the election happened and the unexpected happened there. Mm. And I had to rewrite it. Because I realized in the original draft, the massive brigade was far more violent and sort of recklessly violent. It was wild and out of control because the idea, my sort of the impulse for that group itself wasn't just from this punk group from the 90s, but it was also this feeling of impotence that I feel quite a lot of the time, and I know a lot of people feel when they look at Washington or they look even at their local government and see sort of horrific laws being passed or endless stupidity, and you feel like, I can literally do nothing about this. I go and I vote every 2 years, or I vote in local elections, but nothing changes. So what do? You get frustrated. And there is, you know, when you know, terrorism, a lot of terrorism at least, comes out of a feeling of impotence. Mm-hmm. I literally have nothing else I can do except for set off a bomb or go shoot people, you know, and that was the original incarnation of it. Oof. And I wrote that book. And the book was a mess for a lot of reasons. At the same time, I was getting my TV show Berlin Station off the ground, so I was a bit scattered. And what I realized once I had this early draft was that if I just, you know, fixed it up and kept it the way it was, then that was something that the far right could use to say, look, you know, these sort of anti-capitalist radicals, this is the kind of world that they dream of. Is this chaos? Mm. You know, which the far right will often use to describe, you know, any sort of activist on the left. And I didn't want to give a weapon to what for me is the other side. So, and also the thing wasn't realistic. That was one of the many problems with the book. Uh-huh. And so I rewrote it, sort of rethinking through what it would actually be like. Before it was like this sort of ridiculous fantasy, and it had like it was humorous to some degree. And so in the rewrite, it became much more realistic, and hopefully more realistic, and sort of fit with how I thought some very smart people would want to try and change society.
This punk band, they were called the Nation of Ulysses. Was this a nod to James Joyce?
It may have been. Uh-huh. I'm not sure it was. Okay. But essentially all their lyrics were sort of a mix of 50s hipster speak and Marxist slogans.
Huh. They sound like Crass. You remember Crass?
The Crass?
Uh-huh.
No, I don't know.
Oh, okay. You mentioned Berlin Station. You know, we've never, in all of our interviews, we've never talked about this TV show. What did that run, 3 seasons?
Yeah, it ran 3 seasons, 3 glorious seasons.
Tell us about that, because some of our listeners, I'm sure, have seen it.
Yeah, so this was, I mean, the basic pitch is pretty straightforward. It's set in the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, and it follows the local CIA station there. And, you know, my basic feeling was that there is so much interesting international politics and spying that goes on in Berlin that it's like endless possibilities for storylines there. And so I created this with the help of many people. And I was around for the whole first season, you know, writing with the other writers, and being there on set. And it was an amazing experience. I was extremely lucky that my first idea for a TV show was then made into a big budget TV show.
Mm.
And unfortunately, because I was behind on my book writing schedule, I had to stay away for the next 2 seasons, but it was wonderful. And I think even after I left, I think the storylines that they put together were great. I mean, it was all trying to be at the moment. The first season dealt with sort of a Snowden type leaker. The second season dealt with the rise of the right wing in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the third season dealt with, I really loved this storyline. It was sort of a Russian invasion of Estonia.
Oh wow!
But the way it's not, of course, it's not as straightforward as that makes it sound. It was all done sort of under sort of political cover. It was all pulled off that way. And it was very well done. And you know, I'm sad that it was canceled. It just didn't get the viewership. And it was, Epix is a great channel, but not a lot of people have it. Uh-huh. And they need to make the programs that are going to get more subscribers. And I guess it just wasn't bringing in enough at this point.
Well, I have to confess that I do not have that channel, so I have not seen the program. I think it would be really hard to be writing for a TV series and trying to keep up your writing for novels. So.
No, it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. Essentially, if you do that, you're going to come up, you're going to be, both things are going to be very bad. And also, one thing I didn't know before going in is that TV production, and I think it's probably true of film as well, but I haven't done that yet, is really a 24-hour job. You know, you're on set. It's a schedule on set is 12 hours. And so you, in TV, you always have a writer on set. And oftentimes it was me because I liked being there. But then, so that's 12 hours. And then it'll could take you an hour to get back and forth to home. That's your 13 hours. But then you're preparing scripts for the next day. You know, a lot of the actors will be approaching you to discuss issues with lines or something like that. And all the work is actually kind of wonderful, but there's so much of it that I wasn't getting any sleep for months.
Oh my.
Yeah.
And
which is entirely different than being a novelist.
You're writing on the fly. It sounds like they're coming up to you and they're saying, this isn't working. Can we rewrite this scene? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's usually about like a line or two. It's not about the thrust of the scene.
Okay.
And that's one great thing is if you're working with good actors who are really deep into their character, you know, you listen to them because they're, as long as they're not changing the meaning of the scene, then you can get some really great lines from these actors.
My guest is Olin Steinauer, and we're talking about his book, The Middleman, which just came out in paperback. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And Olin has been on the program a number of times, and I think those previous appearances were booked through your publicist at Minotaur Books. And I Googled Berlin Station because I wanted to know about it and was really kind of surprised to see that one of the main characters in that series has the same exact name as our buddy, your publicist over at Minotaur Books. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's Hector DeGene. When I was first putting together the pitch for it, I wanted names. You have two sort of main characters, particularly in the first season. One I wanted a very plain name for, and that's Daniel Miller. To me, that's entirely vanilla. And the other one I wanted, who's a more sparkling personality in a way, I wanted something cool. And I think at the time I was in conversation with Hector DeGene from Minotaur, and I always loved his name. And so I just said, do you mind if I take this name? And he said, go ahead. I'm sure he didn't imagine anything would come of it. But now he was saying that he gets emails sometimes from, or maybe it's on Twitter or something like that, people saying, are you really Hector DeGene?
Oh, my.
Which means there are a few fans out there, so that's good.
I'm sure there are, Olin. And if it ever comes out on DVD at my local library, I'm going to watch it.
There you go.
So
there you go. Well, just tell them. Tell them they got to get it.
Okay, that's a good thought. The Middleman. Let's dive back into this because the beauty of your stories is that we never really know what the heck is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so much ambiguity and grayness about the story, and I love the twists in this one. Can we talk some more about the way this unfolds without really spoiling it for readers?
Sure. Yeah, I mean to your point that a lot of the twists and turns are unpredictable. That probably has something to do with my writing style, my writing methods. In that I don't know the ending when I get started, which makes for a longer writing process I think there are writers, there are a lot of writers who will outline ahead of time. And so they have this ladder on which they can climb, and they know how that far they are from the end and such. I don't really. I have some general loose ideas about what the story might be about, but inevitably things change as I'm going forward. Mm. And I will have a character do something, and then I'm not sure why they did that. But I have to make sure that the book justifies that. So then I discover, oh, well, that person is really, and I did this, I'm almost done with the follow-up book to this called The Last Tourist. It's essentially done except for all the details that I'm trying to figure out. But I did this where I had a character in there for like 100 pages, and then I realized, oh, that person is a mole. That person is now going to explode everything. Uh-huh. And I did that, and I was, okay, yes, that's good. Then I had to go back, of course, and look at every scene that character had appeared in and make sure that, you know, nothing was contradictory about that without giving it away. So that's one reason why my stories tend to get sort of layered as time goes on. Because if I outline these things ahead of time, they wouldn't be anywhere near as dense as they are. And not everybody does it. You know, some people can do amazingly dense books and outline ahead of time. I just can't think that way. Hmm. I have to go moment to moment and then kind of figure out where I am and then figure out how to get myself out of trouble. So that right there. But yeah, in terms of the middleman, I was following multiple characters. So there's Rachel Proe, I have to say that right, you know, who is sort of your central investigative character. We have another character who is part of the massive brigade, who's one of the people who disappears on that day. Then we have Ingrid Parker and her husband, David Parker. David is a novelist, is sort of a washed-up novelist, a bitter novelist. It's a type I've known, a type I've been, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And Rachel is she is an idealist who ends up getting sucked into the group and gradually becomes a more powerful character within the group. And what I was trying to do was to take this sort of these central sort of ideas of radical change and look at it through a variety of eyes without bogging us down in too many characters. And that's often why I do these multiple character storylines. And it allowed each of the characters to be changed by their experiences, but each to be changed in a different way along the way. And hopefully that works.
You just mentioned The Last Tourist. I pointed out when I talked to you previously about the hardcover release of this book, The Middleman, yeah. that I was pleasantly surprised as I got near the end of the book to realize that this book actually is a tourist book, and we have some listeners out there who are scratching their heads going, what the heck does that mean? What is a tourist? And, yeah. and tell us what that series is about, because it's really
right.
it's a great series.
Yeah, this is a trilogy that I wrote many years ago. Actually, the first book, I turned it in just before my daughter was born. So it's the series and the characters are as old as my daughter, who is 11. So it starts with the tourist, then it goes to the nearest exit, and then An American Spy. And it follows Milo Weaver and his family. He is a member of this secret CIA group department called the Department of Tourism. And you follow his arc through three books as the department, you know, deals with sort of political machinations, but at the same time goes head-to-head with the Chinese Guangbu, their foreign intelligence agency, which becomes an extremely vicious fight over the space of space of these three books. And by the end, the Department of Tourism, I don't know if it's giving away, but mm-hmm. online as well, is the Department of Tourism doesn't really exist anymore. It has been smashed and broken apart. But you're left with the realization that Milo is now taken over his father's sort of parallel department, which is a secret group. It's just an intelligence agency within the United Nations. And so when that book ended, that was within the chronology, that would have been 2008 when that storyline ended. Mm-hmm. Milo is taking over his father's library, they call it. And so now, with the book I'm working on now, is sort of continues his story, but in the present. So it's 10 years later, and things are now going awry in the library. But in The Middleman, I decided at some point that a sort of bit player in The Middleman would be Milo Weaver, because I wanted to keep it within the same universe.
Okay.
And Milo is revealed late in the book, and he's a bit player, but he's also crucial. So without him, all this other stuff might not have happened. And that sort of sense of responsibility that Milo has for having done something, I'm trying to talk around it, for having done something about a decade ago, which then allowed the Massive Brigade to come to fruition, that means he's responsible for it in a way. And in this book that I'm finishing up now, he's aware of that. So there is this crossover between the two books, but they could very much be read separately, and one wouldn't lose too much.
Am I hearing you right in the new book, The Last Tourist, that you're still working on, that Milo's going to be much more in the story?
Oh, it's very much a Milo novel.
Good.
So whereas The Middleman was a standalone with a guest spot for Milo Weaver, this one is sort of the reverse. It is a full Milo novel with a little bit of the Massive Brigade in it.
Well, I can't wait to read it, Olin. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about your work. We really appreciate your time.
No, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
And your publicist just sent me the paperback today of The Middleman, and I was absolutely tickled to open it up and see this blurb. It says, "With his new espionage novel, Olin Steinauer continues his ascent into the stratosphere of spy novel mastery." That's from the Dayton Daily News, and I wrote that.
Ah, see?
Yeah.
You're the reason I have a career.
As if that wasn't enough, I flipped a page and it says, "The Middleman is one smoking hot read. WYSO's Book Nook."
Yes, that's right.
And that's from the podcast that people can listen to. If they go to our website at WYSO.org, they can hear us talking about the book the first time.
That's right. And that's actually the best place to find a good book.
Oh, Olin.
Yes.
Well, thanks again, Olin.
Thanks, Vic.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. The book is The Middleman. And my guest, again, has been Olin Steinauer. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.